an Osho talk. Walking in Zen, sitting in Zen.
Talks on Zen Stories, number 15.
The first question. How does it happen that I feel so at home and so lost in this Buddha field? There is no contradiction in it. It is as it should be. To be lost, utterly lost, is to be at home. Man lives ordinarily as an ego, separate from the whole, like an island with a definite identity, the name, the form. He is somebody, and the whole life we make every effort to go on defining ourselves, who we are, for the simple reason that we don't know who we are. So we create an artificial, arbitrary identity. That's what the ego is. When you enter into a love relationship with a master, that's what entering into a Buddha field is. You start losing your old identity. Your definition becomes blurred. It was arbitrary anyway. It starts melting. Your limits start merging with the unlimited. You are no more somebody. You start becoming a nobody, a nothingness. Hence the feeling of being lost. Because you are missing your old games, trips. You are missing your old miseries, your so-called old pleasures. You are missing all that you had known before as part of your being. A new being is arising, a being which is not isolated from the whole, not encapsulated, but is one with the whole. A wave which is part of the ocean. It is still a wave. But now a deep understanding is happening that I am not separate, that I need not be worried about myself, that I have been before I was born and I will be after I am gone. This being a wave is only a phase, a momentary phenomenon. It is only a question of form. Deep down, I am one with the formless ocean. I am oceanic. This is the experience that is happening to you. Hence you will feel lost. Lost if you compare it with your old identity. And the comparison comes natural, because the old is well known. Maybe for many lives you have been decorating it, maintaining it, nursing it, nurturing it. It is an ancient habit, almost perennial. You have forgotten when it began. It is as old as the creation itself. It has gone very deep. Its roots have gone very deep. Now all that is changing. The old is dying. And you are acquainted only with the old. Hence you will feel like death is happening. But if you look to the new, which is very fresh, just like a breeze, just like a dewdrop, just like a newly opening bud of a rose, very fresh. You are not yet fully aware of it. It is so new. You will need a little time to be introduced with it, to become acquainted with it. But it is happening, because these both processes happen simultaneously. The death of the old and the birth of the new are two sides of the same coin. If you start looking at the new, then you will feel at home. That too is happening. In a very, very vague way, you are becoming aware of that too. Slowly, slowly, the new will become settled. The old will become just a memory, a fading memory, a dream that you have dreamt while you were asleep. Something that had not happened to you, maybe you had seen in a movie or read in a novel. Somebody else's story it was. And slowly, slowly it will go so far away from you that it will become difficult even to recollect it. Then the discontinuity has happened totally. Your umbilical cord is cut. You are really out of the womb of the past. You have started breathing on your own, in a new way, as a nobody. It feels strange to be impersonal, but to be impersonal is the only way to be universal. Not to be is the only way of being. Shakespeare's dilemma, to be or not to be, cannot be resolved by philosophy. It can be resolved only by meditation. Because in meditation, not to be prepares the way for to be. There is no question of choosing. You need not choose between the two. There is no question of either or. Not to be is the way for to be. If you choose not to be, you have chosen the other two. If you choose to be, you will have to pass through the process of non-being. Meditation is a process of death, of non-being, of becoming nothing on your own accord, of disappearing into the whole, into the harmony of the whole. But it is a miracle. The greatest paradoxical experience of life. There is no contradiction in it, but there is a paradox. Looked from the intellectual standpoint, there is a paradox. You ask, how does it happen that I feel so at home and so lost in this Buddha field? That's how it happens. That's the way it happens. That's the way of the ultimate law. Es dhammo sanantano. If you had asked Buddha, he would have said, suchness, tathata. This is how the universal law functions. You disappear and you appear for the first time. But you appear in such a new way. Not as a person, not as a name, not as a form, not as a separate identity, but just a total oneness with the whole, in unison with the whole. That's what is happening here. Slowly, slowly, the energies of the sannyasins are melting and merging and becoming one. Thousands of my sannyasins are functioning in a kind of deep orchestra. They are no more solo players. They have drowned themselves in this Buddha field. It needs guts. It needs courage. It needs intelligence. It needs awareness to move from the known into the unknown, to go into the uncharted sea. You have left this shore. Your small boat is moving towards the unknown. Never look back. The old shore will call you forth. It will try to seduce you. It will give you many promises. But remember, it has never fulfilled any promise, and you have lived on this shore for so long. Don't forget the misery, the pain, the anguish, the nightmares that it has been to you for years together. Now go on moving. Don't look back. Look ahead and always look for the new, the fragile. That which is just arriving on the scene. You will need alertness to to recognize it. The second question. I have been a sannyasin only for 3 days, and yet I have started to dislike the non-sannyasins. What is happening? That's how fanaticism is born. That's how Christians, Mohammedans and Hindus have lived for centuries. That's how the foolish mind functions. Beware of it. Being a sannyasin does not mean that you have to dislike the non-sannyasins. Never look at anybody as a non-sannyasin. Always look at the non-sannyasins as potential sannyasins. They are all potential sannyasins. 3 days before, you were a non-sannyasin. Love them more. Because by your love, you can help their potential to be actualized. If you dislike them, you will become a cause of preventing them from becoming a sannyasin. Help them. This is not a way. But this is how the mind functions, I can understand. Mind is so ugly that it immediately starts creating new trips for the ego. Even sannyas can become a trip for the ego. Now I am a sannyasin. I am a special. And the non-sannyasin, they are stupid people. And just 3 days before, you were a non-sannyasin. Just 3 days before. But it does not matter whether 3 days or 3 years. It is the same. Even after 3 minutes, the mind starts spinning and weaving. It starts walking in a different way, looking at others with condemnation, with that ancient, saintly look of holier than thou. Rastas was tired of being black. One day he came across an advertisement in the local paper which said, Super Omo Special, skin whitening cream, makes skin whiter than white. Very excited, he purchased a packet and went home. He took a bath and scrubbed himself with the product. When he was finished, he looked in the mirror and found that his skin looked like that of a white man's. Ecstatic, he ran out to show his wife, who wasted no time in jumping into the bath herself. She too was very happy when she emerged looking like a white lady. They found their young son and told him, Hey boy, this is your chance to become a white boy. But I don't want to be a white boy, he exclaimed. I am happy the way I am. I am happy to be black. Rastas turned to his wife and said, You know, I have been white for only 1 hour, and already these blacks are giving me shit. Beware of this mind. These are the ways of the mind. A sannyasin has to drop the mind. It has to be alert of the ways the ego takes grip of you. You are not to become holier than others. On the contrary, sannyas simply means initiation into being ordinary. The Pope is addressed as Your Holiness. The Shankaracharya is addressed as Your Divinity. The founder of Hare Krishna movement was addressed His Divine Grace. You have to remember, I address you as Your Holy Ordinariness. There is nothing more beautiful than just to be ordinary. The moment you are ready to be ordinary, you become divine. That's the only way to become divine. God is very ordinary. If He was not ordinary, she would not become the rocks. She would not become the trees. She would not become the animals. She would not become human beings. He would not descend to such lower estates. But He is so ordinary. And He is so happy to be a fish, or even to be a cockroach. To be a beetle. I have heard George Harrison was walking in the garden. And he came across a beetle. And he says, "He beetle, do you know? You must be happy that we have called our group beetles. We have called our group in your name." The beetle looked at Harrison and said, "Do you call your group Eric? My name is Eric." I am no ordinary beetle. Nobody is ordinary. Except very few people, a Buddha, a Jesus, a Zarathustra. These people are ordinary people. They have the courage to be ordinary. In that very courage, they reach to the ultimate depth of being and existence. My sannyasins have to gather that courage of being nobodies. That's what I mean by being ordinary. Our whole effort here is to transform the mundane into the sacred. We don't want to create a rift between the mundane and the sacred. That has been the way for centuries. The rift. That rift has created a schizophrenic humanity. People are constantly in a tense state of affairs. The mundane pulls them to one side and the sacred to the very opposite. If they go with the mundane, they feel guilty. If you enjoy eating and drinking and marrying, then you feel guilty. You are doing something wrong. If you stop eating, drinking, marrying, and you become an ascetic, you start feeling very anxious, very troubled, because you are going against nature. You start feeling, what are you doing to yourself? Is it right? And then you have to constantly repress. You have to avoid the world, you have to escape to a monastery or to the Himalayas. And each small thing creates a problem for you. Rather than solving your problems, you have created 1001 problems. Your so-called saints live only in problems. Everything is a problem. Eating is such a problem. They make so much fuss about it. They will eat this and they will not eat that. The Jaina monk cannot eat poor potatoes. Why? What is wrong with potatoes? They look so innocent. One has never heard anything wrong about them. They have never done anything wrong to anybody. But a Jaina monk cannot eat potatoes. It is prohibited in his scriptures because they grow underground. They don't grow in the sunlight. So something is wrong with them. They grow in darkness. Eating them will create darkness in you, you know. And you have to be a light unto yourself. So anything that grows underneath the earth is prohibited. Carrots and all. Anything that grows underneath the earth. They don't believe in underground things. I am a firm believer in underground things because they are very revolutionary. If you eat them, they will help you to go underground. And finally, everybody has to go underground. So why not prepare? Once I was traveling with a Hindu monk. She will not drink milk from buffaloes. Why? Because Hindu scriptures say the buffalo milk creates laziness, as if Indians can be more lazy. And that Hindu saint was not doing anything. So I said, I don't see what trouble will be there. You don't do anything at all. The buffalo milk can't harm you. You are already lazy. So why be worried about it? Not only that, he used to drink only the milk from a white cow. I said, what is the matter with black cows? Black is an evil color. I said to the saints, then we should part our ways. We cannot be together, not even for a single moment. You are the most stupid person I have come across. Because even from the black cow, the milk is white. Milk does not become black. If milk was becoming black, maybe there was some point in your idea. But he won't listen. And he will take only milk immediately warm, not heated on the stove or on fire. It has to be milked just in front of him so that he can drink it warm from the cow itself. I said, why don't you just do? What the kids do? You just drink from the tits. That will be more warmer. Even milking it and then bringing to you. And it is not so hard that it remains really warm. You just drink directly from the cow's tits. He said, what are you saying? I said, yes, that will make you a far bigger saint. But these fools are worshipped by people. He will eat only food prepared by a virgin girl, otherwise not. How food is affected? Whether it is prepared by a virgin girl or by a non-virgin, how food is affected? He said, there are subtle vibrations. I said, I can trust you only. I will bring 2-3 thalis prepared for you. One by a virgin girl, another by a woman who is married and has children, and third by a prostitute. And you just show me which one belongs to whom, just by the vibe of it. If you cannot judge, then stop this nonsense. Don't talk nonsense. What vibes you are talking? You should drop this idea that only hippies talk about vibes. Indian saints have been talking about it for at least 5,000 years. Now he was at a loss. He could not discriminate. So I said, then you drop it. You don't know what wives are. You are just talking any stupid jargon. It may impress foolish people. But what wives you are talking about? Hindu saints, Jaina saints, Buddhist monks are not allowed to sit in a place where a woman has been sitting before. A certain time has to lapse. After that they can sit. Because that place goes on radiating sexual vibes from the woman. These people are utterly mad. But these are the ways of the ego. To make a demarcation that they are a special, a spiritual. They are not ordinary, mundane, worldly. Otherwise, how to make a discrimination? How to condemn ordinary people? You have to create something. Anything will do. Jaina monks pull their hairs. They can't shave them. They can't use scissors. As if scissors are a great technology. They avoid technology. As if a blade is a great technology. They will pull their hairs. Utterly stupid. But thousands of people gather to see them pulling their hairs. Because they are doing great austerity. Do anything stupid, but do something which is unnatural. And people will start worshipping you. Christian monks used to beat themselves every morning. There were sects of Christian monks who will whip themselves every morning. Their bodies were continuously bleeding. Their bodies had wounds all over the, from foot to head. And the man who will whip himself the most will be thought to be the greatest saint. And people will gather to watch and count who is whipping himself more, who is bleeding more. Now these people who were whipping themselves were masochists, and the people who had gathered to see them were sadists. They both were ill, pathological. But this pathology has persisted. My whole effort here is to drop this division between the mundane and the sacred. I want you to live a very ordinary life, so that you don't have to go on any ego trips. Remember, 3 days are 3 years, are 30 years. It is all the same. Time makes no difference. Beware of the fact that the ego is very cunning and it will try to find out ways to puff you up. This is a very simple way to dislike the non-sannyasins immediately. You are special. And they are ordinary people. They don't understand. and you understand. They are all potential people. Love them, help them, respect them. That is their decision whether to be a sannyasin or not to be a sannyasin. That is their freedom. It is your freedom. And freedom should be respected. The third question. Can you give me a new Zen koan to meditate, because for all the old ones I can find the answers in the Zen scriptures. Okay. Just the other day, a young German took sannyas. He was a man of deep feelings, a man of heart. He was sobbing with joy. I asked him, "How long are you going to stay?" He said, "Bhagwan, forever." I said to him, "When you come next time, stay a little longer." Now meditate over it. This is a Zen koan. And you will not find the answer in any scriptures. Even I don't know the answer. The fourth question. Why are you talking about it so much? I know that it is a touchy subject. But you know me. And that explains everything. The fifth question. Are children really so intelligent as you always say they are? They are far more intelligent than I say they are. Every child is born absolutely intelligent. Because there is nothing to distract his intelligence. He has no prejudices to be unintelligent. He has no information to be unintelligent. He has yet no knowledge. Even if he wants, he cannot function in a knowledgeable way. How he can be stupid? Stupidity needs few qualifications. You have to go to the school, to the college, to the university. Stupidity needs few degrees. You have to MAs, MSCs, PhDs, D.Litts. Stupidity depends on knowledgeability. The more knowledgeable you are, the less intelligence is needed. Because knowledge starts functioning as a substitute. You can depend on knowledge. Why bother? You can simply look into the memory and the answer is there. But the child has no memory. He has no ready-made answers. Whenever there is a problem, he has to face the problem. He has to encounter it. He has to respond. He cannot react. And to be responsive is to be intelligent. He functions from a state of not knowing. That's why I say every child is born intelligent. But almost everybody dies stupid. Because this whole life is structured in such a way that it is impossible to remain intelligent. Almost impossible. Only very few people have been able to escape from the trap. The trap is such. And the trap gives you all kinds of comforts, conveniences. It is supported by the government, by the religion, by the society. It has all supports. The day I resigned my post of professorship in a university, I burnt all my certificates. A friend used to live with me. He said, "What are you doing? If you have resigned, I don't agree that you have done the right thing." But burning your certificates is absolutely unnecessary. You may need them someday. Keep them. What is wrong in keeping them? You have such a big library. They won't take much space. Just a small file will be enough. And if you cannot keep, I will keep them. You just give them to me. Someday you may need. I said, I am finished with all this stupidity. I want to burn all the bridges. And I will never need. Because I never look back and I never go back. I am finished. It was all nonsense. And enough, I have been in it. But I had not compromised with any vested interest. That's why I had to resign. Because I was not teaching what I was supposed to teach. In fact, I was just doing the opposite. So many complaints against me reached to the Vice Chancellor that finally he gathered courage to call me. He never used to call me because to call me was an encounter. Finally he called me and he said, "Just look, all these complaints are here." I said, "There is no need to bother about the complaint. This is the resignation." He said, "What are you saying?" "I am not saying that you resign." I said, "You are not saying, but I am resigning. Because I can do things only that I want to do. If any imposition on me is there, if any kind of pressure is put on me, I am not going to be here even for a single moment. This is my resignation, and I will never enter into this building again. He could not believe. I left his office, he came running after me. When I was getting into my car, he said, "Wait, what is the hurry? You ponder over it." I said, "I never ponder over anything." I was doing the right thing. And if there are complaints, and of course I know there are complaints, there must be. Because I am not teaching what your stupid syllabus bonds me to teach. I am teaching something else. I am not talking about philosophy, I am talking against philosophy. Because to me, the whole project of philosophy is a sheer, stupid exercise into futility. It has not given a single conclusion to humanity. It has been a long, long, unnecessary journey and wastage. It is time we should drop the very subject completely. Either a person should be a scientist or he should be a mystic. There is no other way. A scientist experiments with the objects and the mystic experiments with his subjectivity. Both are scientists in a way. One is of the outer, the other is of the inner. And the philosopher is nowhere. He is in a limbo. He is neither man nor woman. He is neither here nor there. He is impotent. Hence he has not been able to contribute anything. So I cannot teach philosophy. I will go on sabotaging it. I was just waiting. Whenever you call me, I have to resign immediately. It is very difficult to get out of it. Because all my friends came to persuade me. The professors came to persuade me. All my relatives tried to persuade me that what are you doing? Even the education minister phoned to me that don't do such a thing. I know that your ways are a little strange, but we will tolerate. You continue. You don't take any note of the complaints. Complaints have been coming to me too. But I am not taking any note. We don't want to lose you. I said, that is not the point. Once I have finished with something, I am finished with it. Now no pressure can bring me back. It was very difficult for me to be in the school because I could see the stupidity of the teachers. And they used to get angry. They used to think that I am trying to be mischievous. I was not trying to be mischievous. I was simply trying to show them that this is all nonsense you are teaching. It has no concern with life. My geography teacher used to talk about places. I told him I am not going to visit these places ever. So why should I remember? Now how am I concerned with Constantinople or Timbuktu? Whether they are or not is irrelevant. All that I want to know, where I am right now, you tell me this. He was almost dumb. He said, where you are right now? No student has ever asked me. My whole life I have been teaching geography. I said, then you never had a single student. I want to know where I am right now. My whole concern is now and here. My history teacher used to teach about me, about stupid kings and their names, and I said, I am not going to memorize them. Why? Why? What they have done for me? They even didn't know my name. So why should I remember their names? It should be a give and take. Now this Nadir Shah and this Timur Lane and this Genghis Khan, what they have done to But this is how we go on imposing stupid information, unnecessary. And the load becomes heavier. And the person who carries the biggest load earns biggest rewards. Naturally, when stupidity is rewarded, you settle for it. Intelligence is punished. I was so much punished, you will not imagine how much I was punished from my primary school up to the university. I was continuously punished. And nobody was ever able to tell me why they are punishing me. It was almost the case that I was standing outside the class. It was very rare for me to sit inside the class. But that exercise has helped me. I have done so much exercise walking outside a class that now I need not do anything. I have done enough. Whenever my headmaster used to come for a round, I was the only person always walking in the corridor. Whenever he will not see me, he will come to my class and say, what is the matter? What you are doing inside? I said, I don't know. I am myself puzzled. Because a single question and the teacher will say, you go out. Unless you stop asking, you cannot come in. And it was a good excuse for me to be in the out, in the air. And that was so beautiful, to be in the out with the birds and with the trees. So whenever I wanted to go out, just a question, any question will do. Any question that was unanswerable. I was turned from one college, expelled from this university to that university. One university accepted me, but accepted with the condition that I will not ask any questions. I said, I can accept that, but then you have to do one thing, that I will not go into the classes. Because if I am in the classes, and if the professor says something stupid, I cannot resist myself. The temptation is too much. And there will be arguments. And I will forget all about the promise that I have given. I will not ask questions. So you have to give me permission that I need not attend classes. And I will be given permission to appear in the examination without fulfilling the absolutely necessary requirement of being present in the class at least for 75% days. He said, that is my promise. And I was so happy. For 2 years I simply never turned to the college. I came only when there was examination. And the principal said, you are a strange man. I was thinking once in a while you may not come. But for 2 years I had not seen you at all. I was sending even my fee by post. Because I said, even with the head clerk giving the fee, or saying hello, something may happen. He may ask, how are you? And that's enough. You know me. You just ask, how are you? And then I go on for 90 minutes. And that has been my usual practice. So I avoided all contact just to fulfill my promise. But it has been a boon, a blessing. Children are certainly intelligent, very intelligent. One little boy was overheard saying to another, if I could have known what trouble parents were, I would never have had any. How did you like the new preacher, son? Asked the mother. Don't like him much. He preached so long, I could not keep awake. And he hollered so loud, I could not go to sleep. A little boy lost his mother in a big department store. A young man who was working there sees the crying boy and asks him, what is the matter? I have lost my mother. The boy mumbles through his tears. What does she look like? The man inquires. She looks like a woman without me. One six-year-old boy was reprimanded by his Sunday school teacher, you have been nothing but trouble. You are just a rotten kid. The little boy pulled himself up to his 3 foot height and answered, that's not true. I'm so a good boy. God made me and he did not make me junk. I had a funny dream last night, Mum. Did you? I dreamed I was awake, but when I woke up, I found I was asleep. Two small boys were swinging on a gate together, passing the time of day. In the course of their conversation, one asked the other, how old are you? I don't know, said the other. You mean you don't know how old you are? No. Do women bother you? No. You are four in that case, observed his companion. Papa, said little Johnny, how do babies come into the world? The stork brings them, son. Hey, Pa, don't tell me you did it with a stork. A little boy comes home from school one day and says, hey, Mommy, I just saw a flat catch. Who? Says his mother. How did you know it was flat? Because there was another cat pumping it up. The sixth question. It took you 700 years to get here. What happened? Don't you know the Indian trains? The seventh question. I am going to tell the truth. I am a British lady. My great-grandfather was governor of Delhi, and my great-uncle was prime minister of Kashmir. I know there is very little hope for me, but is it not possible to defy the laws of nature and fall in tune with you in spite of this unfortunate heritage? Don't be buried. Truth liberates. You have confessed the sin. That's the beauty of confession. Now there is no worry. Henrik Heine was dying, and these were his last words. God will forgive me, it is his trade. So don't be worried. Even if you are British, God is going to forgive you. All that is needed on your part is to confess. And don't take my joke seriously. British are beautiful people. I love them. The eighth question. I cannot control myself when insulted. What should I do? Tit for tat till you become enlightened. And do it quick, because once you are enlightened, then it is very difficult to do anything. When somebody insults you. You have simply to accept it. Es dhammo sanantana. So whatsoever you want to do, do it right now. Finish it. Because here soon you will become enlightened. It is not very far away. And it is natural, when somebody insults you, you cannot control yourself. I have never been telling you to control yourself, because control can't help. If you control, you repress. Control is another name for repression. If you can watch, watch. Otherwise, if there is a question between repression and indulging, prefer indulgence than repression. Because indulgence will teach you a lesson. Repression won't teach you anything. And you are not a machine. You are a man. Warning in the year 2000, due to robot shortage, some of our bartenders are human and will react unpredictably when insulted. You are not a robot. So it is natural. It is better to react truly. But remember one thing. You are free to do whatever you like. You need only face the consequences. Because I am not saying that you won't receive blows back. So first watch who is the other guy. Be a little careful. And you are alive, you are not dead yet. Once you are enlightened, you are almost dead. Alive on the other shore, dead on this shore. So before that calamity happens, enjoy doing whatsoever you can manage to do. Mulla Nasruddin was studying electricity. To show the class its practical uses, the teacher commanded that each pupil bring some electric tool to class the next day. The following morning, the class held a small exhibition: electric bulbs, irons, a hair dryer, an oven. When Mulla arrived, he was sweating and carrying a big artificial lung on his back. "Mulla," said the teacher, "where did you get that electric lung?" "I took it from Grandpa, teacher." "And he did not mind?" she cried. "I don't think so, teacher. He just said, rrr." So before that happens, don't try to control. Do something. There is nothing to be worried. Accept your humanity. It is part. If somebody insults you, he is challenging you for a fight. So give him a good fight. If you see that he is too big, then meditate. What else to do? The eighth question. I am a mathematician. Can I also become a sannyasin? I don't see that there is any difficulty. You can be a sannyasin. Of course, you will have to learn something more than mathematics. You will have to learn a little poetry, a little music, a little dance. You will have to go beyond the calculative mind. You will have to take a little jump into the illogical, into the paradoxical. And of course, habits die hard. So I can understand your problem. Mathematics is pure logic. It is nothing but logic. And sannyas is very illogical. Or, if you like big words, then it is supralogical. But that is only a word. The fact is, it is illogical. So if you are ready to go a little beyond the boundaries of logic, then you are welcome. It is going to be a little difficult, but not impossible. There are mathematicians here. There are scientists here, whose whole life was devoted to some logical methodology. But now they have moved beyond it. And they can move only if they have a deep longing to know whether there is something more to arithmetic or it is all. If you are really an explorer, if you have some adventure in your life, then there is no problem. I can understand your question. You may be too much addicted to your mathematics. Then there will be difficulty. All addictions create difficulties, and these are deep addictions. If you are addicted to some drug, it is not so difficult. Within 6 weeks' time, you can be hospitalized, treated, and you can get out of it. But if you are addicted to logic, it may take a very long time. And unless you decide with your total being to come out of it, there may be no possibility by anybody else to bring you out of it. A mathematician goes to the whorehouse, very excited, he picks the prettiest girl and goes off into a room with her. They say you girls from the capital do very incredible things in bed. Yes, we certainly do, she replied. So I want one of your specialities. I have one that you are going to love. Come here. Let us do a 69. That appealed to the mathematician. 69? Immediately, he understood the language. 69, that comes within his world. So they jump into bed and the woman does it very well. He loves it. When they finish, he falls over onto his side, takes a deep breath and says, "This is too much. I think I am going to quit the other 68. But a mathematician is a mathematician. He is still calculating. If you remain calculative, you can become a sannyasin and you may still remain calculative. What is happening? What is not happening? How many days I have been meditating? How many hours I have meditated? And what is the result? And what is the outcome? Is it worth? All these things will have to be dropped. Meditation is the world of lovers, not the world of calculation, but the world of love. If you have fallen in love with me, then you are welcome. You say, I am a mathematician, can I also become a sannyasi in Dharmavir? Yes. But my feeling is the trouble will come from somewhere else. You are also an Indian. To be an Indian and to be my sannyasin, that is far more difficult than to be a mathematician and to be my sannyasin. The Indian has lived with an idea of sannyas for at least 10,000 years, and I am putting things completely into a chaos. I am putting things topsy-turvy. My sannyas is not the sannyas that you have always understood it to be. It is totally different. I call it sannyas only to confuse you. I could have given it a new name, but that is not my way. I thrive on your confusion, on your chaos. My whole effort is to sabotage all patterns, all pattern thinking. That's why I have chosen the orange color. I would have chosen any color. In fact, the best color that would have fitted my idea of sannyas would have been a rainbow dress. All the seven colors. Because my sannyas is a rainbow phenomenon, multidimensional. That would have been absolutely in tune with my idea of sannyas. But I sacrificed. I have to destroy this Hindu idea of sannyas. I have to create so many orange people that the old saints and sannyasins get lost. Nobody knows who is who. Your being Indian may create a little trouble. Mathematics you have learnt only in this life. But being Indian may be part of your collective heritage, may be part of your collective unconscious. So when Indians become sannyasins, they come with a priori conclusions, expectations. And when they don't find those expectations here, they feel very much disturbed. I would like you to be alert from the very beginning that this is a totally new vision of sannyas. The old sannyas was renunciation. My sannyas is rejoicing. The old sannyas was otherworldly. My sannyas contains both the worlds. It is not one-dimensional. It does not condemn this world. It makes this world the foundation for the others. The old sannyas was spiritualistic. My sannyas is not spiritualistic and against materialism. My sannyas is materialistic, spiritualistic. My sannyas is not anti-scientific. It contains science in it. It is vast enough to contain it. It goes far beyond it, but it is not against it. An Arab strayed with his camel in the desert, felt very horny. Finally he grabbed the camel and tried to make love to it. But every time he tried, the camel moved aside and the Arab missed. After a month of straying in the desert, he came across a road which led to a town on the edge of the desert. There, sobbing, sat a sexy young lady next to her broken chariot. Seeing him, the young lady begged him to fix her chariot, promising that he would not regret it if he helped her. "Ah, my sweet savior," she said as he finished, "come to me and I will reward you." "Thank you, lady," replied the Arab. "Would you just hold this camel for me for a minute?" The 10th question, is there any such thing as a real marriage? Never heard. Real marriage? There are real marriages, but no real marriage. If it is real, there is no need for marriage. The very need for marriage arises because there is fear. If you love a person, you love a person. You can be together with the person. But there is constantly a fear that the other person may leave you. And the other person is also afraid you may leave him or her. To make the future guaranteed so that you cannot leave, so that the other cannot leave easily at least, the marriage is invented. Marriage is invented only because love is missing. And if love is missing, how marriage can be real? There is no need for marriage. If love is there, marriage is an unnecessary phenomenon. In a better world, where people will be more mature, they will be together because they love, and they will keep each other free, because one never knows. Love may disappear. And that does not mean that love was unreal, that's why it has disappeared. That too is a very wrong idea that has prevailed for centuries. We have been obsessed by wrong ideas and they are creating such trouble in our life, still we can't see their wrongness because they are so old and we have become so conditioned to them. If love disappears, we start thinking then it was not real. infects a real rose flower is bound to disappear by the evening. Only the plastic rose flower will not disappear. The real rose flower blooms, opens up, dances in the wind, in the rain, in the sun, and by the evening is gone. It does not mean that it was unreal. In fact, it was so real, that's why it appeared and disappears. The plastic flower is so unreal that it does not appear and does not disappear. It remains. It is far more permanent. Marriage is like a plastic flower. Love is a real rose. And people are such cowards that they don't want to live with real roses. They are far more hankering for security, safety, guarantee, permanency, that they are ready to risk the real roses and they purchase plastic flowers. Of course, those plastic flowers cannot satisfy you. You will remain miserable. Just 1 month before, Sagar Priya wrote to me, "What has happened? I have been here for 2.5 years. Has something gone wrong? Because I and Bindu are still together. I did not answer her question. Because I was afraid if I answer it, something will happen immediately. So I kept quiet, and it has happened. Now I can answer, because now I will not be thought responsible for it. Now Bindu wants to escape. But Sagar Priya is not going to leave so easily. Just to escape from Sagar Priya, he wants to go for few weeks to America. Now Sagar Priya is following him. She also wants to go with him. We don't allow freedom to each other. We cling to the very last. We try every possible way. Even when everything disappears, we go on clinging. We go on hoping against all hope. And the more we cling, the more we destroy the possibility of love renewing itself again. Now if Sagar Priya can allow Bindu to go and be there for a few weeks alone, he needs his own space. Everybody needs once in a while. Because love alone is not enough. Love is beautiful. But meditation is far more important, and meditation needs a deep aloneness. Nobody should interfere, and only lovers can interfere in meditation, because only lovers are so close. The marketplace does not interfere. The people who are not related to you cannot interfere, but the people who are very close, very intimate, can be a real disturbance, and they don't allow you any space. And if you want to be alone, they immediately start feeling as if they are being rejected. You simply want your own space, and everybody has a need. a tremendous need to have his own space. But now Sagar Priya will follow him. If there is any possibility, she will destroy even that. The best thing is to let him go, to say him goodbye in a nice, beautiful human way, with no grudge, with no complaint, with no quarreling. If you quarrel too much, if you make it such a fuss, then people start compromising. But compromise cannot fulfill you. And remember, men are so much tortured in the outside world, in the office, in the factory, in the shop, everywhere, that at least at home they want peace. For their peace, they compromise. Hence, almost all husbands become henpecked. And the problem is, no wife can love a henpecked husband. And every wife tries that the husband should be henpecked. This is how we create misery. In the first place, marriage is wrong. Marriage means clinging, legal clinging. You have a legal support. You can force the person to the court. You can create so much financial trouble for him that he will think it is better to tolerate whatsoever is. And howsoever it is going, I have become accustomed to tolerate it. It is only a few hours question in the night, and then he escapes in the morning and finds 1001 excuses. Overwork in the office, a party somewhere, or something else. He becomes a Rotarian, he becomes a member of the Lions Club. He finds ways and means to avoid. He starts drinking, so when he comes home, he is so drunk. He can't hear what the wife is saying. He does not know what is being done to him. But how can you love such a person? You hate such a person. But this is how you create the person. And the man also is a clinger. This is a very strange thing. In each couple, one is always a clinger. This is my experience of thousands of couples. It seems one has to be a clinger. Anybody will do, either the wife or the husband, one has to be a clinger. And whosoever clings is miserable, and the other is miserable because he has lost his freedom. And you cannot be happy with a person who has lost his freedom. Love is a meeting of two free individuals. It is not a marriage. Love does not need marriage. And if love disappears, which is far more possible, then vice versa. It does not mean it was unreal. The more real it was, the quicker it will disappear. The more intense it was, the quicker it will disappear. Because it will give you such ecstasy. And then those peaks cannot be reached every day. It is bound to disappear. But man does not want peaks of joy. He rather wants a smooth, comfortable, convenient, bourgeois life, which is almost not life at all, but just vegetating. So people are vegetating together. cabbages and cauliflowers vegetating together. There is no real marriage. There is only real love. All marriages are unreal. But to live a real love needs really a courageous heart. It needs that you should live moment to moment. And you should remain open for the tomorrow. Whatsoever surprises it brings, it brings. And you accept them. Even if your lover departs, you have to be courageous enough to give him a beautiful goodbye. As beautiful as you say hello, you have to say goodbye too. Because he has given you such moments of joy, you have to be grateful to him. The 11th question, what do you say about divorce? Some great philosopher said about divorce, I forget the philosopher's name. In fact, I forget what he said. But I say, divorce is useless. You get married for lack of judgment. Get divorce for lack of patience. Then you remarry for lack of memory. In fact, marriage is wrong. Once marriage disappears from the world, divorce will disappear on its own account. I am against divorce. I want divorce to disappear from the world absolutely. But the only way to do it is to destroy marriage completely. The last question. Laughing this morning was so pleasurable. I felt like a baby that is being played with and tickled. Please tickle some more. The traveling salesman's car broke down on a lonely country road just before nightfall. And being unable to repair it, the salesman trudged to the nearest farmhouse to beg shelter for the night. The farmer said, okay, but as there was only one bed, the salesman would have to share it with the farmer and his pretty young wife. In the middle of the night, the salesman, feeling horny, began making love to the wife. She said, okay, but please see if my husband is asleep. Pull a hair from his chest to check. The salesman did, and the farmer slept on. Sometimes later, feeling horny again, the same thing happened, another hair, more love making, and then again a third time. But this time the farmer exploded. Look, he shouted, it is okay to fuck my wife, but quit keeping a score on my chest. An Italian arriving in Australia for the first time gets a job on a farm. The first day the farmer's wife complains that the new worker has been chasing her chickens around the yard. The farmer says he is new and to give him a chance. But later she is even more outraged when she sees him drinking his own piss. The farmer tries to console her by saying he is a good worker and that this is probably normal in Italy. But later on, the farmer sees the Italian with his head right next to his prize bull's arse while it is having a shit. this is too much for the farmer. Racing up to the Italian, he shouts, "What the hell are you doing? First you chase my chickens, then you drink your own piss, and now what are you doing with my bull?" The Italian says, "But my friend Shah tell me that when I get her to Australia, I am supposed to chase the chicks. Drink I plenty of piss and listen to Allah the Sitch." Enough for today.